Hello and welcome to another episode of Healthy Minds. I'm Julie, your host, and I've got a new special guest here today. Would you like to introduce yourself?
Sure. My name's Savannah Fox. I am a peer advocate.
Okay, great. Can you tell us a little bit about what peer advocate means?
Sure. So it just means that I am a person who has experienced living through some of these issues, and I try to help talk about it, raise awareness, and help other people work through the same kind of thing.
Cool. So if we had to sum it up, you're like a coach, maybe, with the lived experience.
Sure.
Yeah? Okay. So today we are going to be talking all about non-suicidal self-injury or self-harm. So this is your content warning for the whole episode. Okay. So if at any time you need some help, you can call Grassroots 410-531-6677, or you can call the National Lifeline, which is 1-800-273-8255. So what makes it non-suicidal self-injury versus, you know, when we talk about suicide attempts, which is a common question that we get in any sort of our trainings that we're talking through. So I will quickly share the definition. So one, there is disorder in the DSM-5 called non-suicidal self-injury disorder. And so it could be that you have this diagnosis, but it's likely that many people will not have the diagnosis and that self-harm is part of their symptomology or the way that their mental health issues are presenting. And so the difference between non-suicidal self-injury and a suicide attempt is the intentionality. So were people intending to harm themselves or were they intending to die? And so that would make the difference between the two. So Amanda is here today, which is so great, to talk a little bit about her own personal experience with self-harm. And so we have a couple of questions ready and we're going to share some stats and we're going to talk about treatment and all that good stuff today. Yeah?
Sounds good.
Okay, great. So onset. So the clinical educational standards here are that onset is around age 15. Would you like to share about your experience?
Sure. So I was in the very end of middle school, so probably a little bit before that, maybe 13 or so, mm-hmm. when I started my battle with self-injury.
Okay. And so when we say average age of onset, that's, you know, if you're going to get all fancy with statistics, right, that's taking all the different onset ages for people and you're, you know, having them essentially. So 13 makes perfect sense to me. As we also know, not to put you on the spot, but, you know, puberty, right? Everybody's been through it at some point. And if you haven't, you shouldn't be listening to the show because you're too young. But hormones are wacky. Teenage years are hard. And there's a lot that goes on at that time. So it makes perfect sense to me that, you know, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19. No, I'm just kidding. Any age would be normal, so to speak. And I'm making little air quotes here because we just have the average age of onset. So I have the statistics about prevalence, meaning how many are actively self-harming. And when I say actively, I don't mean like literally at this moment. I just mean that they are within the symptomology of self-harm. So you guys have been filling out youth risk behavior surveys in high school, which are looking at the socio-emotional side of school, essentially. And so the Youth Risk Behavior Survey shows us that about 17% of adolescents, meaning between 12 and 18, have self-harmed within the last year. And then we have other prevalence data that tells us about 13.5% are of young adults, meaning from 18 to about 35 are also self-harming. And then they have adults in general. So unfortunately, people don't talk to each other about cutoff ages. So they mean somewhere around like probably 25 or 30 on up. It's about 5.5% of adults are self-harming. So this surprised me, even though I've done the work in the field, I was really surprised to hear that about 17% of adolescents had self-harmed. And I'm just curious if you can maybe speak to this, but did you have friends that were self-harming in high school that you knew about?
Yeah, so they're definitely, and I don't know how different it is because when I was in high school, the internet was like just becoming a thing. So I feel like that has definitely changed the way things work to some extent. But there was definitely a bit of, it wasn't something that was talked about, but if you happened to find someone that also had the same issue, mm-hmm. then like all of a sudden you guys had something in common that mm-hmm. like no one else had. And so I had like some friendships kind of based around like the shared negativity, which, like, if there were other things that the friendship was also based around, it could end up being a positive relationship. But if it ended up being, like, just based on the fact that, like, we had the same struggle, yeah. but, like, there was nothing else, like, that wasn't necessarily, like, the greatest relationship, obviously.
Right.
And it could feed into each other, which could be problematic as well.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. That's a great point to talk about. So I like how you started off with, like, the internet or whatever, but I would argue that your statements about, like, making friends are applicable to any age, any time, mm-hmm. right? And as teens and even young adults, maybe, and maybe adults, I don't know, it's really easy to latch on to, like, one thing about somebody and be like, haha, now we are buddies because I know something about you. But you want to examine why you're buddies. And so if it's all negative, that's an indication that it could be a toxic relationship and something that you want to examine a little bit there. Okay, so one of the big questions I get from parents, having, again, worked in the field, parents or concerned citizens, so to speak, is why do people self-harm, right? So I know, first off, that it's just not that easy, right? It's not like, aha, here is the answer. I have found it. But sometimes it can be. So can you share with us a little bit about maybe what was going on at that time in your life? We'll just start with that and get into the more complicated thing.
Okay. Yeah, I think, well, you're right that there's definitely, like, there's no one size fits all answer for why someone would start self-harming. I do think that the adolescence can play a part of it. It certainly did for me. I think for me, I like to tell people, like, mess around, like, with psych terms, but, like, when I hit metacognition, thinking about thinking, right? Like, my brain wasn't ready for it. So I was not... there was a lot of things. I had some stuff that had happened in my past. There was a lot of things. I just wasn't prepared. And all of a sudden, my brain had, like, more power than it had before. And I didn't know what to do with it. Mm. I didn't know how to handle things. And so, like, what I like to tell people about self-harm is that it's a maladaptive coping skill, right? So it's a skill that you're using to survive a situation, but it's not one of the best ones, right? And everyone has maladaptive coping skills. A lot of people will drink or eat or do whatever to feel better about something for a little bit of time. It was something that I found that worked quickly and addressed some of the issues. And so for me, I just, my life was changing a lot. My grandfather had died. He was pretty much like the stability factor in my family. We had to move, so I had to change schools, and it was just a lot of, I felt like I had lost control, and I found something that helped me feel like I had a little bit more.
Yeah. So you mentioned a couple of things. So great. So we talked about emotional regulation. We talked about control. What else did we mention in there? Probably a little bit about your brain. I love that. Okay. So I'm going to talk about that for a hot second. So the brain piece is the prefrontal cortex. And I've talked about this before if you've been listening for a while. So the prefrontal cortex is that front part of your brain, like you can smack it if you tap your forehead kind of thing. And it doesn't stop growing until you're about 25. Now, let me tell you what the prefrontal cortex is responsible for. Judgment, decision making, emotional regulation, impulsivity, abstract thinking, personality. It's all stuff you kind of need to be an adult, right? Which is why, if you know, you go back to the first episode, we talked about Dr. Arnett and the emerging adulthood, the new developmental category of the, like, 18 to 25 year olds. So go listen to that if you haven't. But anyway, so the prefrontal cortex is so important, and it is why we see a little bit of the spike or onset, essentially, around the teenage years in combination with teens are kind of jerks to each other. Let's be real, right?
Very true.
We're all like, I don't do that. And then we do that. And I don't know what that's about. But anyway, classic teenagers. And then we got hormones. We got, like, dating. We got, you know, you're kind of an adult, but you're not. You got to get a job often. There's a lot going on for our poor little kids here. And then we hop into college, and it's like nobody actually prepared you to be in college, to be an adult, to have your own independent thinking. So it can be really difficult around that time. So I love that you were like, I wasn't equipped to think about thinking. I think that's great. So let's see, you talked about control too, right? So this feeling of not having control, essentially. And so you found something you could control.
Yeah. I'm in recovery from an eating disorder. And I think that that's another way that I had kind of found to control. I couldn't control what was happening in my life, but I could control the food that I was eating, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So I'm so glad you mentioned that. There is a statistic out there that says about 40% of people that self-harm also have an eating disorder. And so I think it's because many of the root causes are so, so similar. So control is something that pops up a lot in both self-harm and eating disorders. So it makes perfect sense that, you know, if you have one thing, you know, eating disorders or disordered eating could be a form of self-harm as well. So it might just kind of naturally evolve a little bit from there. Something else that goes with this is over-exercising. A lot of times I'll, and this always makes me mad, this is one of my soapboxes. I have so many soapboxes. But when I hear somebody say something like, oh yeah, I'll eat that cake, but I'm going to have to run it off later, I'm always like, there's no morality to food. There's none. Like, just eat the damn cake, right? Enjoy it. Don't punish yourself for it later. Versus, you know, I want to exercise because I want to feel healthy and I like the way I feel when I'm exercising, or, you know, I have a goal that I want to achieve. But if you're exercising to like punish yourself for food that you ate, or because you feel like you don't fit into whatever ideal that you're trying to, this is not healthy. Eat the donut, have toast, eat whatever, right? You can't cut out all carbs and still be healthy. Okay, so let's talk about some of the other causes. And I have causes in quotes, even though nobody can see me doing that except for, you know, Amanda here and Chris, who's recording us. But when we say causes, we don't mean simplistic, like, aha, A has happened, so now B will, right? It's more like, I always talk about the iceberg or the Venn diagram of mental health, right? It's way more complicated than one thing. But when we talk about the, like, preceding emotions, essentially, we have coping with stress or negative feelings. You talked about that, right? Mm-hmm. So you had so much stuff going on and you called it a maladaptive coping skill, which is great. Let me translate that for those of y'all that aren't in this field. This basically means that instead of taking a bubble bath or, you know, perhaps going for a run in a healthy way or wrapping up in a fuzzy blanket, which are coping skills, you may choose to self-harm, which is also a coping skill, but it's a bad or a maladaptive or non-ideal. I'm trying to think of all the other ridiculous words I've heard. But anyway, it's still a coping skill. That's still how you're coping. It's just
not the best one.
Right. It's not great. Did you ever have this sensation of wanting to feel something physical? So you felt very numb and maybe disconnected and you needed to feel something.
Yeah. So yeah. I had some issues with dissociation. I have a diagnosis of post-traumatic stress disorder, and that's like common with that. And so sometimes it would just be like, if I could feel something physical, it could bring me back to like the present and reality.
So what you kind of mentioned was grounding, which is something we've talked about before in our anxiety episodes. You can go check those out. But grounding is something that's really helpful for people. And this would be a maladaptive grounding technique.
Yes, not the grounding technique that you want to learn.
Right.
But right. One that does work when you don't know what grounding techniques are and you just like stumble across something that happens to be a grounding technique.
Right.
Just not a good one.
Yes. And so really quickly, in case you don't have time to go listen to the whole 30 minutes or 60 minutes of this, grounding techniques are things that will help center you. And they often involve all the senses or some of the senses. And so you can Google 5-4-3-2-1 grounding technique. That's probably the best one to use, I would say. Would you agree?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So feeling a sense of control. We talked about that, right? Mm-hmm. So I know this might seem confusing to somebody that has not experienced it or like isn't in the field or working with people like this. So let's unpack it a little bit maybe. So when you feel like your life is totally bananas, right? We all feel this at some point, right? I literally just had this 2 weeks ago where I was like, right? You want to find something that you can control. And so everybody does this in a different way. So for people that have maladaptive coping skills, they may choose to self-harm, or that might be the only thing that they think is available to them. For me, I get the largest paper in my house, which is 24 inches by 36 inches, and I write down all of the stuff I have to do. Because when I feel very like disconnected or like I can't control stuff, it's because I have way too many obligations going on. And that's another story for another day. But I write down everything because it's kind of like a grounding technique. I am physically writing it out. It doesn't work if I type it on my phone or type it up on a list. I have to write it out. And I stick that sucker up right in my kitchen, which annoys the crap out of my boyfriend. because he's stuck looking at my to-do list, right? But it really helps me to physically cross off stuff on my list. And so that's the way I choose to cope with it. Although, if you don't know that lists make you feel good.
Yeah, and that's something that you've learned, right? Probably as an adult. Mm-hmm. Whereas, like, when you were 14, you weren't like, this is the way to make myself feel better. And that's the thing is, like, those things don't necessarily occur to us, especially when it's the first time that, like, most things are occurring to you, right?
Yeah. So right. So I was very fortunate to have a grandma who is obsessed with lists. So this is actually something that I learned from, like, a young age. So I have lists from when I was, like, 5 or 6. And they would be like, you know, get toy, right? I mean, like, go eat snacks. I mean, it wasn't anything big, but lists was something that was very talked about in our household, which is great. So how did you learn about self-harm?
So I had a friend who, I mean, at that time, I think I was, like, madly in love with him, but, know, who started around, like, right before the time where, like, all the upheaval happened in my life, and I was, like, trying to help him with it. But then he was like, I was trying to, like, also understand. And so I was like, why would you do this? And then, like, as he was, like, explaining it to me, and then, like, so then for some reason, like, when I got upset, I was like, well, I could try that because he said that that worked. Yeah. And so, like, that was, whereas, like, no one had been like, here are, like, some healthy ways to handle, like, hard things. Like, no one had ever said any of those to me before. So I just tried the one that someone mentioned.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you for sharing that. So I think that's such a great point because it's not something that maybe, like, naturally pops up in our head to be like, you know what I should do? I should hurt myself. It's more social learning. So we've learned it from other people. And that's something that I heard from a lot of the clients I used to work with is that they didn't start self-harming until they went to the hospital and saw other people self-harming or heard about their stories and heard how it helped that person. Because it is a maladaptive coping skill. So this was how this other person's doing it. When you're stuck, when you're feeling overwhelmed, you can't control stuff. Nobody had a grandma at age 5 telling them to write lists down, etc. It suddenly becomes an option, right? You're like, well, I guess I'll try that, right?
Yeah, and the thing you want to consider when you're talking about things like self-harm or any other, like, maladaptive coping skills is that the... Typically speaking, like, the reason that they stick around for so long is because they're very powerful and, like, they're very effective in the short term. But, like, in the long term, they're very harmful, right?
Yes.
So you want to emphasize that they are very harmful in the long term. But when you're trying to do, like, if your therapist gives you, like, some basic coping skills. Like, I remember my first therapist who was awful, but she gave me a list, like a printout of, like, basic, like, coping skills. And the only one I remember, because it was something that actually helped me sometimes, was, like, hug a pillow. But she, like, gave that to me as in, like, do this instead. And in my mind, I translated into that, like, hugging a pillow should work as well for me as self-harm does, which is just not the case, right? And so it took me a long time to realize that, like, with healthy coping mechanisms, it could take, like, several to get me to the same spot that, like, one self-harm, like, attempt would. And so it's important to, like... to make sure that, like, when, if you're talking to someone about this or if you're, like, giving someone resources to, like, help people understand that it's just, like, that hugging a pillow, right? Like, telling someone to hug a pillow is fine, but, like, don't expect that to, like, cure them of self-harm for forever, right?
Right. Yeah. And that's such a great point to bring up is that a lot of people are stuck or maybe afraid of leaning in, even the professionals, of, like, leaning in and finding out some of these causes that we were just chatting through, right? And figuring out what is sparking this maladaptive coping mechanism and then, you know, understanding that it does release endorphins, dopamine, all this stuff. And we can get addicted to the process of self-harm because of the feelings it releases, not the actual act, but the feelings that it's releasing. We also just really quickly, so that would induce positive feelings, right? Endorphins, dopamine. Yeah. And so it also could be a way of communicating. Right. So hoping that somebody is going to notice and take you up on it.
Yeah. So I had a therapist. The first therapist that I had that actually helped me deal with anything was in college. And he actually specialized in eating disorders, self-harm and trauma disorders. And
great.
He was I was with him for several years. Yeah. And he was a great therapist. But he told me that, and this was true for me. It's not necessarily true for everyone, but that every time that I wanted to hurt myself really I needed to communicate something to someone.
Right.
And that was something I was trying to avoid doing. It would be like I didn't want to cause a problem for someone else, so I would rather cause a problem for me. And so that was very much my experience with self-harm.
Yeah. And I think that's really important to be aware of. So sometimes adults or concerned individuals will be like, they're just attention seeking, which is another one of my soapboxes. We won't go too far down that. But instead of attention seeking, it's more like connection seeking or attention needing. So for some reason, the phrase attention seeking just has all this weight and judginess on it. And so if that's the case, then flip it and say it's connection seeking. They're hoping to connect with somebody. And if this is the only way that they have to communicate that, whether to themselves or to other people, that's a big problem. And you need to follow up on that and do better, essentially, and lean in instead of expecting them to reach out. Okay, so we've talked through causes, and we've briefly talked about like socially acceptable self-harm. And I just want to explain that phrase really quickly. So I don't want people to be like, Julie said it's okay to self-harm. No. So socially acceptable self-harm is things that people do that would be considered socially acceptable behavior. And it's stuff that all of us do and probably have done at some point. So one of them would be this eating thing, right?
Yeah. So like someone breaks up with you and you eat a carton full of ice cream, right? That's like the standard.
So delicious.
It's like the standard.
I have never done that ever. Yeah. Okay. Over-exercising. We've talked about that. Overworking and being busy. I found that really interesting and, you know, always reflecting on my own self and my own mental wellness at the time. But, you know, how many people like layer and layer stuff on so that they don't have time to think and process, right? So it's a distraction technique, or, you know, they feel like they're not good enough, so they're going to do more so that they can fill this void in themselves. And so I think that's really important that everybody knows that overworking and busyness can be a form of self-harm. And I've certainly seen this in some of my friends. I've seen this in myself sometimes where I have like really just piled stuff on and then been like, because your physical and mental health suffers when you don't have time for yourself, for self-care. And so it's really important that we know about that, essentially. Some other things like toxic relationships. So I don't mean like, you know, everybody in an abusive relationship is doing it for self-harm. That's certainly not the case. It's far more complex than that. But people that are choosing to stay in toxic relationships that are able to leave, and they're staying in it specifically because the other person does make them feel bad about themselves. So I had a client once who literally said, you know, and they were like buddies, like best friends. And it was to the point where I was like, I need you to stop bringing best friend with you because you're my client. They're not. I need to have time with you kind of thing. And they said, I only keep her around because she makes me feel like crap. And I was like, like, that seems so counterintuitive. And so then we had like this really great exploration of like the root causes, like we've been talking through here. So like, okay, so why do you want to feel like crap? Like, what's going on there? Tell me. Not setting boundaries. So this goes with the overworking and the toxic relationships and like everything else. So if you have no boundaries, then you are not mentally well. You need boundaries. You have to be able to be like, no, I don't want to hang out with you on Friday because I don't do anything Friday nights. That is my me time. Or on the flip side, no, I don't have the capacity to do that project right now unless we switch something else out, right? So boundaries are incredibly important. Everybody needs them. If people are upset by those boundaries, that means that they were taking advantage of you. Right.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of things, like I mentioned before, there's a lot of things that people consider more socially acceptable. Mm-hmm. I mean, for a while, I switched to alcohol after I was 21, because after you're 21, no one is concerned about you drinking. Right. And so I could go out and get trashed and no one would be like, they would be like, oh, you're in your 20s. You know, no one's like, oh, this is a call for help. This is attention seeking. Yeah. This is that. And so it was the same kind of thing where I was like, I could cause harm to myself. But it wouldn't upset anyone else.
Yeah.
And so I was like craving that because for self-harm like is upsetting to other people, right?
Yes,
so
right.
Like self-harm thrives in isolation. Mm. And when you bring it into the light, you start to have some problems.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. So alcohol, great one to talk about. I think we're getting a little bit better at recognizing when people are having like problems, although it's really tricky in the early 20s because that's like expected.
Everyone is having problems in their early 20s with alcohol.
Yes, I would almost certainly agree that most of our college students are doing a little too much. I think it's like 50% have binge drank within the last month, and that's like over 4 drinks if you're a female. So just think about that for a hot second. 5 drinks if you're a male. in one sitting. So then just really quickly, because, you know, we have so much to talk about, but it's important that we cover some of this. So some other things you might see: picking scabs, getting tattoos or piercings. And I don't mean like I have tattoos and piercings. I didn't get them to punish myself or to feel pain or whatever. I got them because I wanted them, you know. And then nail biting, I think I talked about smoking, like all that stuff. Anything that you can think of that causes you discomfort or physical harm or emotional harm, it's also important to acknowledge, could be considered self-harm. So let's talk about treatment super fast. So you mentioned having a bad therapist to begin with, and it was because they didn't actually acknowledge root causes.
So I started out with, I had several therapists. I even had one who said in college, I think you've grown out of this. And I was so offended because I had been working so hard to not self-harm. And then she was like, oh, I think you've grown out of it. And I was like, no, I did a lot of work for that.
Yeah.
But so seeing someone that like actually understood like the concept of self-harm and wasn't like, oh, that looks like that hurt. Well, yeah, that was the point. Oh, that's what they always say. Are you serious? This is someone at a psychiatric facility saying this. Yeah. It's just like, what are you doing? Mm. So like having someone have a concept of like, this is a like cause and effect type thing, right? Mm-hmm. Like there's, I'm getting this, I'm doing this because I'm getting something out of it, right? Mm. Seeing someone that understood that was really important.
Right.
And I also have found DBT to be really helpful, mm-hmm. which was originally designed for people with borderline personality disorder, but basically anyone that has like the types of behaviors mm-hmm. that are like harming themselves in some way, it can be really helpful mm-hmm. for. So I personally am a big fan of DBT, think we should teach it to children, think everyone should just learn it all the time.
Yeah. So DBT, in case you were struggling to catch those consonants, because it can be a lot, is dialectical behavioral therapy. And it's useful for anyone that struggles with emotional regulation, I would say, in general. And so I would also say a lot of people struggle with emotional regulation. And that's something that, like you said, everybody can benefit from. So I encourage you to go Google that. So we're wrapping up here. So two questions. One, what would you say to somebody that's never self-harmed? Like if you had to give them a sentence or two to explain it, maybe.
Just understand that like it is a coping skill, and just because it's not one that occurred to you or that like you thought of doesn't mean that it didn't make sense at the time for the person particularly. Mm-hmm. And to try to consider it like the socially acceptable ones that we mm-hmm. talked about, right? Where it's just like this is a person making a choice for them in this moment. Mm-hmm. It like the stigma around it is like one of the main reasons that people don't seek help, mm-hmm. right? And so if we could reduce some of the stigma around self-harm and just realize that it's just a thing that people do to try to get by in life, then we might mm-hmm. be able to get people help and healing a lot sooner.
Yeah, great. Thank you. So what would you say to somebody that is actively self-harming? And I don't mean, again, when I say that, I don't mean like they're standing there right now about to hurt themselves, although maybe, but like it's in this period of their life.
I would say get help. And I mean that in multiple ways. I mean like get professional help, like find someone who either specializes in it or maybe just DBT mm-hmm. or something, but also have friends that you can talk to either because you're upset and like about what you're upset about, or just someone that you can talk to because you need a distraction. Like, and you need multiple of each of these types of friends, right? You need people that you can talk through mm-hmm. and be like, this is what's happening right now. And this is why I'm upset.
Yep.
And you need people who are like, I just want to talk. Let's go to movies. Let's like eat popcorn and watch Titanic.
Yeah. I want to reiterate what you said earlier, which is that healthy coping skills often take more work and longer to work. So you have to stick with it. And I know that's hard. And I recognize that you're in that place if you are. And so self-care send off. We're at the end of the episode. Boom, it happened. So what is a self-care tip you would like to share with our friends here?
I've recently started, I guess, within the past 6 months or so, doing meditation every night before I go to bed. Mm-hmm. I use the Headspace app, which is really convenient. It does cost money, but there's a student price,
nice.
So that's nice.
Okay. Yeah.
And sometimes they have sales and stuff, but it's a good way for me to make sure that I'm setting time for myself every day.
Yeah, I like that. So mine, I think, would just be to explore other coping skills. So we often get stuck in a rut, and not every coping skill will last us through our lifetime, or they might come back. And so, you know, if you're somebody that likes fuzzy blankets, great, but make sure you have more than one and, you know, different situational self-care kind of things. So that wraps up our episode today. Thank you all for listening and wishing you good mental health.
Connect with us. We are Dragon Digital Radio.